This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Spiders are amazing creatures. Now, before you shudder at the word and run away from the radio screaming, just hear us out for a sec. Spiders can catch things we don't like aphids, mosquitoes, and flies. If you leave them alone, they'll happily eat all of the insects in your home. But their appetite for bugs isn't the only reason Dr. Cheryl Hayashi finds them fascinating. Hayashi is the Leon Hess Director of Comparative Biology Research at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. She specializes in spiders, primarily researching their silk. Actually, it's silks. It turns out some spiders can make more than one, depending on what they need the silk to do for them. Dr. Hayashi will give the Science on Tap lecture this Thursday evening at the Milwaukee Public Museum on the secrets of spider webs. She joined Lake Effect's Bonnie North via Skype from her office in New York to explain why spider silks are such a big deal.
Most people know that spiders, you know, make silk. You know, you kind of see silk here and there, whether or not you're looking for it. You know, it's in your yard, it's in your garage, little corners of your windows. But what's super cool about spider silk is that it's not just one thing. There's many kinds of spider silks. And that's what I want to get across to people. Why spiders have so many silks, what the different kinds of silks do, and their amazing properties.
So any individual spider species has many different kinds of silks?
Every spider species has at least one kind of silk. Most spider species have multiple kinds of silks, but there are some species that make just one kind of all-purpose silk. I kind of call that like the duct tape silks. You know, if you got one, it's going to be a multi-purpose tool. But in many species, they've really specialized their silk. So they don't have just one kind of silk. They have many kinds of silks. For example, orb web weaving spiders, which that's the kind of spider that makes, you know, like the round wagon wheel shaped webs that you might see in your yards. Those spiders have seven different kinds of silks.
Seven. Wow. Okay, so are those seven silks in that web that you would see in your yard, is that just one of the seven?
Well, in a web, in a typical web, you might see about six different kinds of silks go into making that web. The seventh silk is actually used to make a tough outer coating on egg sacs. So that may not be actually in the web. It may be off to the side if a female spider has, you know, laid her eggs for the season. But in constructing the web and in making a capture web, yeah, like six different kinds of silks would have been used, and they would have been used in some places singly and in other places in different combinations. So when people say spiders weave silk, I mean, that is just the perfect word. They really are weaving, and they're taking a little bit of this silk A and silk B and mixing it all together.
So in an evolutionary idea, why would they have evolved to have these seven different kinds of silks, this particular kind of spider? I know there are many different kinds of spiders, but let's just keep it to the orb spider for this moment.
Yes.
You know, what does that do for them in evolutionary terms?
Well, in evolutionary terms, it means that there's been natural selection to have a particular kind of silk that's very good at doing a particular function. And so it allows spiders to have really, you could think of it as like a toolkit to do a variety of purposes. So let's going back to the orb web, the function of the orb web is to catch prey, specifically flying aerial prey, insects, flying insects. And the best way to do that would be to make a web that's made up of a different number of materials, and each of those materials would be a different type of silk. And just like think about when you build a house or you build a car, you're going to use different kinds of materials for the different parts of your house or your car.
One of the things I think that fascinates me as a non-scientist about silk is its tensile strength. Is it true that it's one of the strongest materials of its kind in the universe that we know of?
Yeah, that's not an understatement. So it's not true for all spiders and all silks, but there certainly are spiders that make particular silks with strengths that rival high tensile steel. And certainly, if you talk about this property called toughness, which is the amount of energy that a material can absorb before it fails, many spider silks are remarkably just really like off the charts tough. And it is better than almost anything else that has evolved or that man can make.
How did you get interested in spiders and the silk specifically?
I got interested in spiders when I was in college. And it was through, you know, doing research in a professor's lab. And that was just really, really important that, you know, I had the opportunity to get involved with research. And one of the parts of getting involved with research was to feed the animal colony. And so the animal colony turned out to be a spider colony.
Interesting.
And that's how I got started. And, you know, just when I started working with spiders, you know, I hadn't been particularly afraid of them, but I wasn't like I was, you know, particularly like fanatical about them. But just the experience of, you know, day in and day out working with them, making observations, it made all my classes and just what I was thinking about, it just kind of like distilled down to a system that I could look at and start asking questions about. And then finding out that, wow, there's a lot that's not known about how spiders use silk and make silk.
What are some of the things that we have learned about it recently that we didn't know before? Particularly, I'm thinking of the making it. It seems like it's one of those things that they can make as needed.
So like in the lab, I can, you know, take a spider and I can start reeling. So like, you know, basically hold the spider and pull out dragline silk with my fingers, and I can wrap that dragline silk around a little spindle, and I could really, you know, roll out about, oh, I mean, meter after meter after meter after meter. I mean, pretty much until I get bored doing it. And it's amazing. The spider, you know, I can easily go 50, 100 meters, and the spider is just doing it. And it's really hard to really convey like just how remarkable that phenomenon is, because inside the spider, the silk is liquid. So inside the spider, it's not like there's spools of thread in there. It's liquid. And as I'm pulling it out, you know, it's really like, you know, pulling out, going from liquid to this fiber. It's a phenomenal process, and it's happening in real time, near instantaneously. Or just think about, you know, that spider dropping down from a branch, all, you know, to the ground, or you see a spider dangling from, you know, your window outside, you know, to your patio. That is all happening in real time. It's possibly, you know, the fastest transformation, or definitely one of the fastest transformations of liquid to solid protein there is. There's nothing in our bodies that can do that.
No, I was going to say we probably would have harnessed it by now if
yeah,
we could
literally make a harness out of it.
Yeah, and literally, yeah. And so, you know, when we think of silks, I think if we're thinking about it at all, we're thinking about silkworms, and we're thinking about the fabric that makes. And is there a reason why we have not done that with spider silk?
Well, with silkworms, there's, you know, this whole thousands and thousands and thousands of years of, you know, the Silk Road and all the development of the domestication of silkworms. So let me just back up a little bit and explain that silkworms, that's an example, silkworm silk and spider silk, that those are examples of what we call convergent evolution. So it's different species have independently evolved very similar solutions to a challenge. So for silkworms, they make this protein in their salivary glands that they then spin into a fiber, and they use that fiber to make a cocoon to wrap around themselves while they're going through that transformation of, you know, a caterpillar to a moth. Mm-hmm. And so that's coming out of their mouth. And for spiders, they have these silk glands in their abdomen, and they use those silks for a variety of purposes, from basically, you know, when they hatch all the way through their juvenile stages to when they're adults for a spider to reproduce. So it's used throughout their life. And so, you know, one species, it comes out of the mouth, and one other species, it's coming out of their abdomen. And so that's convergent evolution. And a huge difference between them is that silkworms, they're basically vegetarians. So they're very easy to have domesticated and mass rear by thousands, millions, really, you could, you know, have a farm that you can just raise silkworms. You feed them mulberry leaves, or you could make some sort of, you know, artificial diet, and they'll happily just eat silkworm chow. While spiders are predatory. And that's a huge difference. That means spiders require live food. You have to feed them live prey. And so it makes it very challenging if you want to mass rear them. Also, because most spider species make more than one kind of silk, it becomes challenging if you want to, you know, let's say sell or, you know, harvest mass quantities of just dragline silk. But how do you be sure you're getting just dragline silk when that spider can make seven different kinds of silks, as an example?
Yeah, that makes sense. Because I was thinking, with its tensile strength and, you know, and the toughness that you were talking about earlier, that you'd think we'd have tried to figure out how to mass produce that in some way. But now I understand why it would be difficult.
Yes, it'd be hard to do it just in spiders. So if you were to just rear spiders, you know, that's, it's, would be very, very labor intensive, and it all just becomes really prohibitive, like the amount of space you need. You have to rear food of all the different insects of all different sizes to feed to spiders of all different sizes. And then how are you going to, you know, collect the correct silk from that spider? But the approach then has then is you could take a spider silk gene, and if you could move it, if you could insert that gene into like a plant or a bacteria culture, some sort of host organism, that's a lot easier to maintain. And that's been the strategy that biotechnologists have taken to want to mass produce spider silk. So you move it to a host organism that's not a predator, and you just put one silk gene in them.
And has that worked?
Yes, that's been working. So there are labs around the world that have successfully done this. So, and they've done it both on kind of a small scale, and they've also done it on, you know, larger scales. So you can just put the silk gene in bacteria, the bacteria grow and make express the protein, and then you researcher would have to, you know, purify the silk protein out of the bacteria culture. Another approach has been to put the spider silk gene actually into silkworms. So there's, you know, DNA technologies now where you can actually put a spider silk gene into a transgenic silkworm and have the silkworm not only make the spider silk protein, but actually also spin it into their cocoon silk.
Wow.
That's super cool.
That is super cool. Wow. It's almost a Frankenstein monster kind of cool, you know? It's like,
yeah,
we're creating like silkworm spiders. Oh, no.
Exactly. And perhaps, you know, the most famous host of making this artificial spider silk has been a herd of goats that are currently at Utah State, where spider silk genes have been inserted into those goats in a way that the silk gene is expressed in the goat's mammary glands. So that means mama goats can be milked.
Wow.
And there'll be some silk protein mixed into their milk.
And then you can extract it from the milk.
Exactly.
We're talking about all this really cool stuff, and I said earlier that I think spiders are very cool, but I know sometimes I'm in the minority, that a lot of people have a very atavistic reaction to either spiders or snakes or both. You know, they're just like, ugh. What is some of the things that you, when you talk to people, like you're coming here to talk to a general audience, what are some of the things you tell them or try to reassure them about spiders so that they can maybe work against that reaction of like, ooh, I have to kill it?
One of the things that people, you know, should be aware of is that we are not in the repertoire of prey for any spider. There is no spider that's hunting people. And so whenever the unfortunate, you know, human spider bites happen, it's because the spider is being defensive. And so I think if people realize that the spider is being defensive, the spider is trying to protect itself because it's feeling threatened by you, or you didn't know the spider was there, you know, underneath a shelf, and, you know, you reached your hands into that dark area and you didn't know, and that the spider is not out to get you. I think that's something that, you know, people have to kind of realize and understand that. And, you know, I collect spiders all the time, and in my experience, The spiders are afraid of me.
Well, I'm one of those people that, you know, if I find a spider indoors, you know, I will take them out. You know,
yes.
I capture
yeah.
them on a piece of paper or something, and I take them outside so they have at least a chance of catching something to eat.
Or finding a mate, because many of the spiders in our homes are going to be males that are wandering around looking for a mate. And yes, when people see like spiders that are routinely in there around them, you know, remember they're not plants. They don't photosynthesize. They're getting energy from somewhere, and they're a predator, so there's something to eat.
Right, and it's usually something you don't want in your house.
Yeah, or yeah, you're not able to catch yourself.
Right.
So they're doing you a favor.
Exactly. Well, Dr. Hayashi, I want to thank you so much for taking time to talk with us today. We're really looking forward to the presentation at the Milwaukee Public Museum when you're here. And thanks so much.
Oh, thank you. It's been fun.
Dr. Cheryl Hayashi is a curator, professor, and Leon Hess Director of Comparative Biology Research at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. She'll be giving the Science on Tap lecture on the secrets of spiderwebs this Thursday evening at the Milwaukee Public Museum. There's more information at wuwm.com.